Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Tyson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Colorado Denver, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Carrie Figdor and Robert Talese. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Rocío Zambrana, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Emory University. Her book, Colonial Debts, The Case of Puerto Rico, is just out from Duke University Press. What can debt reveal to us about coloniality and its undoing? In Colonial Debts, Zambrana theorizes the way debt has been used as a technique of neoliberal coloniality in Puerto Rico, producing profit from death on the island. With close attention to the material practices of protesters who have fought that destruction of life for profit, Zambrana argues that decolonization entails political economic subversion and transformative interruption of the hierarchies of race, gender, and class that fuel and are sustained by colonization. She shows us how organizing pessimism nourishes hope. Rocío, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's get started by talking about your background and how you got to this project about debt and its relationship with coloniality.
Okay. So this project is, in a way, it's a very old project. So I grew up in Mayagüez, Puerto Rico, and stayed for college in my hometown at the University of Puerto Rico in Mayagüez. When I was initially a psychology student, but then switched to philosophy when I realized that that was a thing, a discipline and a practice that one could actually do. I was introduced to philosophy through an ethics course that Anaida Santori Jorge taught. And, you know, rather than teaching your standard Aristotle, Kant, you know, and so on. She taught Foucault and Arendt and cases of institutional violence in Latin America. And I just thought, you know, this, whatever's happening in this classroom, that's what I want to do for always. So I wrote a BA thesis, was really wanting to write a BA thesis on the transition from Spanish to U.S. colonial rule. And I did that despite the fact that some other I had some pushback from other members of that department at that time, who thought that this wasn't kind of philosophy proper. Of course, Santori was just incredibly supportive and wonderful. So I wrote about, you know, colonialism and Puerto Rico, that this was, you know, 2000. And at the University of Puerto Rico, and then, you know, went to the New School for Social Research to do a master's and then a PhD in philosophy. And, you know, then was interested in and, you know, just did my duty in the discipline. but became interested in, Marxism, critical theory, and therefore also German idealism. So I ended up writing actually a PhD thesis that had to do with Hegel, which, you know, I drew from that a bit for my first book, had to do with Hegel, normativity, and it also had to do with critical theory and conceptions of critique and critiques of capitalism and kind of arguing kind of a critical engagement with second and third generation Frankfurt School critical theory. So when I started as an assistant professor at the University of Oregon, I worked on my first book on Hegel. And then when I turned to my second book, I thought I would write the book on critique and the book on, critique, capitalism, neoliberalism. And I wanted to return to questions of Puerto Rico, especially since I had been working on, since my time at Oregon, since I arrived there, I started working on more precisely on decolonial thought, especially Aníbal Quijano, and the concept of coloniality of power. These debates about decolonial thought and decolonial feminism in philosophy. I was bothered by the fact that, that we weren't talking about the colony of Puerto Rico, which is, not yet had gone through a genuine decolonization process. And I wanted to, despite the fact that in 1952, it had a drop of constitution, and 1953, it had been taken off of the UN's list of non-self-governing territories. So I wanted to then write this book, but kind of exploring how neoliberalism and neoliberal rationality function in Puerto Rico. But when I started to work on that project, I realized that the book should be about the debt crisis, which was, starting to really, take a new turn. This was in 2000. I started writing the book properly 2016, which ended up being a pretty historic year because of the passing of the Promesa law that instituted a fiscal control board in Puerto Rico, and a Supreme Court case in the U.S. Supreme Court that, really put to rest any doubts about whether the decolonization process that had gone on in the mid-century had been successful. It was revealed that, sovereignty, questions of sovereignty and self-determination still remain within the U.S. Congress insofar as Puerto Rico is still and remains still to this day an unincorporated territory of the United States. So I started to work on the book on debt. When I started to work on the book, I thought, well, of course, there will be tomes of books on debt as a form of coloniality. I was interested in the notion of coloniality of power and decolonial thought in this kind of Latin American key. But I ended up not finding quite finding all the tomes that I was hoping to find. It was clear to me that debt is a form of a continuation of the colonial condition, and what I was interested in exploring and thinking about was how it is a continuation of the colonial condition in the colony, not in a post-colonial context, but in a still colonial context. In the Caribbean, of course, that to think of debt and colonialism is to always start from Haiti in the 19th century. The what is called the independence debt that was levied on Haiti by France and its allies as a retaliation for the the one successful slave revolt in history and the founding of the first Black Republic of the Hemisphere. So I thought that there would be quite a bit of literature on debt as a not just the continuation of the colonial condition, but as a form of coloniality. And I did find a lot of interesting and very fruitful and important points of contact. But the particularities of Puerto Rico was just very required building up and also not even building up, but documenting a lot of the conceptual articulation that was happening on the ground in Puerto Rico itself. So in a way, it's a continuation of that project that I started my answer with and at the University of Puerto Rico in Mayagüez as a BA student, thinking about how is it that colonialism is installed and how it is adapted in altered material historical conditions. But of course, these are very particular conditions, and it's a very, it's a reflection on, very, very contemporary set of events.
Yes, I mean, your analysis brings us through, for instance, Hurricane Maria, right? So, which again changes the conditions on the ground that people are responding to and organizing against. So this has been a work of 20 years in some ways. Of a couple of decades. You begin your introduction with it is an epigraph from Marx that is, coats are not exchanged for coats. But that quotation, it turns out, is part of a longer epigraph that is a poem by Raquel Salas Rivera. Would you talk us through how that poem helps to set up the relationship between coloniality and debt in the book?
Yeah, so Raquel Salas Rivera's Lo Terciario, The Tertiary, is just an incredible book published in, I think, 2017, if I'm not mistaken. And in the book, he rewrites, kind of Marx's account of value through the case of Puerto Rico, one could say. And this particular poem, Coats Are Not Exchanged for Coats, caught my attention throughout the writing of the book entirely. I come back to the poem at the very end of the book. In a way, the poem just captures many of the moves that I make throughout the book. What Salas Rivera does in the poem is really walking us through kind of the structure and the strictures of debt as a form of deferral, as a form of diversion, which is temporal and material, and as a way of establishing, a hierarchy. So it kind of indexes this material history that runs through not just labor but value, and not, I don't want to say just culture. I want to say, race, gender, class. It ends by kind of taking it to its ultimate conclusion, the work of debt as a form of capture, by making the land itself, the rivers themselves, into the ires, the errors of the debt. So the poem is structured around, when I say that it's structured around the strictures of debt, as a form of deferral and diversion, is that one of the kind of the main tropes of the book is to try to really understand how does debt operate? And it operates by opening a form of temporal gap. It has to do with kind of a binding yourself to a future, a promise or a promissory note of repayment that binds you to a future, purportedly irrespective of changing or altering conditions. In a debt economy and financialized neoliberal capitalism, that itself becomes, right, the generator of value and profit. This is not particular to neoliberal capitalism. Of course, debt is not. But what I am exploring is how it is functioning here in this colonial context, in this colonial context, and in the context of neoliberal financialized capitalism in a post-financial crisis context. So Raquel, he really, kind of hits every possible point, kind of establishing kind of the relationality, you know, that debt functions as a form of capture insofar as, the bank capital and the colony itself, because the debt is a colonial debt, the capital slash the colony or colony itself captures through a form of deferral, whereby, payment is not really its end, but despite the fact that as the poem moves, there's an offering of my life to pay for the debt, but, that is never enough. The bank, the colony, ends up asking for the rivers. So there is a range there from value in terms of economic value to sociality itself, to land, river, so the question of ecological debts as well. So it moves us also from this financial, historical, material debts to these historical slash material debts. It was just a very striking poem that really I think captured many of the things that I was not only thinking, but really that were being articulated within a lot of the not just debates, but the forms of resistance in Puerto Rico, especially throughout those years, 2016, 17, and ongoing.
Yeah, and you've begun to sketch then for us this relationship between debt as a mode of neoliberal capture and subjection, and debt as a form of coloniality. And so can we talk now about how they meet or land in Puerto Rico? What the sort of austerity, but then also as you're starting to sketch the resistance to austerity in Puerto Rico, why do we need to understand that relationship, I guess, between on the one hand neoliberalism and on the other coloniality, which you've begun to give us, but why particularly in Puerto Rico?
Right. So in a way, the thesis of the book is trying to think about, and I always apologize when I say this because it's like a mouthful, but I always want to think about, or the book tries to think about or track how coloniality operates in the colony. And, that might seem convoluted, abstract, philosophy talk, but it's very, what I mean is something very, very concrete. And I try to make it as concrete as possible throughout the book. And so this notion of coloniality, I should mention that I distinguish it, or it's distinct from the notion of colonialism. So one might just very minimally, the most minimal sense, think about colonialism as political, juridical subordination or control. But the notion of coloniality of power that was developed by Aníbal Quijano, a Peruvian sociologist, and the way that it has been transformed in the hands of many decolonial feminists like María Lugones, Judith Espinosa, Ocho Curiel, and others, that notion tracks the way in which the persistence of the race, gender, class hierarchies installed and initiated by conquest and colonialism as a historical fact. It's how its persistence, how that race, gender, class hierarchy survives decolonization projects. So the notion of coloniality and coloniality of power, coloniality of gender, is a notion about the kind of the adaptation or the forms of updating the racial order that is the necessary feature, that is really the invention of the installation and subsequent like mutations of modernity capitalism, mm-hmm. Or capitalist modernity. So I want to make that distinction between colonialism and coloniality, especially in the case of Puerto Rico, because I'm sensitive to and worried about the fact that Puerto Rico, as an unincorporated territory of the United States, is still in a straightforward juridical political sense, mm-hmm. a colony of the United States. But decolonial or projects and processes of decolonization that, do not, that stay within the purview of the self-determination of nation states, do not necessarily center, the racial order that is not just the legacy, but the continuing form of operation of colonialism. Mm-hmm. So I keep coming back to a quote by Ariana Godreau in the book that the colony transcurre or happens in repeated acts of capture. So in a way, I keep coming back to the question of where is the colony? What is the colony? So because I'm sensitive to projects of decolonization, which we've seen throughout the 19th century and the 20th century, kind of replicate a racial order in its very projects of independence. This is what Quijano and others in decolonial thought were worried about or tracking. And of course, in the Caribbean and in other places, this kind of critical assessment of decolonization processes. Because I'm sensitive to decolonization processes that do not dislocate the racial order that is kind of the defining feature of the project of modernity and capitalism, I'm interested in tracking how coloniality operates in the colony, and how they relate to each other. So in the context of contemporary Puerto Rico, the indebted colony, I try to track the way that, neoliberalism functions as and through a debt economy, but how then it kind of reinstalls, updates both the colonial condition, the territorial status, insofar as there is a fiscal control board that was, instituted by the passing of the Ley Promesa, Law Promesa, by the U.S. Congress. Despite the fact that, Puerto Ricans residing in Puerto Rico have no presidential vote, no representation in Congress. So that's a way of kind of reinstalling the colonial condition or updating it. But what I'm interested in is really how how coloniality operates in that context, and in particular, how race and therefore also gender and class, not just hierarchy, but modalities of violence and precarization are adapted and updated through this debt economy. So not just the debt crisis, the way that debt and debt restructuring through PROMESA, feeds austerity, feeds privatization, and many other projects that are, eroding all the material conditions for Puerto Ricans living in the territory, but especially for racialized, mm-hmm. for Black and non-white Puerto Ricans that are already marginalized or navigating precarious conditions. And at the same time, we see material conditions being created for and renewed for, creditors, corporations, and, rich individuals through tax-exempt foreign investment and in the realm of real estate. So neoliberalism, here kind of neoliberal coloniality functions through kind of the two sides of the same coin that are debt and austerity. So that debt kind of, it functions as an intensification of all these neoliberal measures that have to do with privatization and, the shift of the cost of social reproduction onto populations, what Lazzarato calls this inverse redistribution of wealth, right? Mm-hmm. So what I do is I in the book I'm trying to track how the debt crisis, which is really kind of a debt economy, adapts a racial order and intensifies its effects through the mechanism of debt and debt restructuring. Another way of putting it, so austerity, but another way of, an important feature, kind of the most concrete example of this is taxation in Puerto Rico. The colonial political economy throughout the 20th century and under U.S. colonial rule was always this notion of development. And of course, this mm-hmm. notion of development is a kind of a supremely like colonial apparatus in the mm-hmm. sense of, it installs all these imaginaries and desires of modernization, technology, so on and so forth, and relegating to the past any form of life that is not, to the image of modernity, capitalist modernity. So throughout the 20th century, and it's starting in 1917 with triple tax exempt bonds, already in 1906, the U.S. Congress was discussing, tax exemption or tax exempt investment for the development of infrastructure in the territories. So in 1917, this is kind of installed in Puerto Rico, and it continues throughout the 20th century that tax exempt foreign investment is the apparatus through which economic development is pursued and modernization is pursued and so on. That actually generates a condition of a flight of profits, not reinvestment in the local economy. It doesn't actually impact. It doesn't actually ameliorate questions of unemployment, and so mass migration to the U.S. has always been part, even in times of economic boom, have always been part of the political economy of Puerto Rico. So today we see that in the realm of real estate, attracting not just corporations, but also wealthy individuals through tax exemption. While we have as part of debt restructuring, regressive taxation. So, consumer tax here in Puerto Rico is 11.5%. Mm-hmm. So you have, a 44% population living below the poverty line. But of course, taxation is severe for those populations, while tax exemption is generated, coupled with question of privatization and so on, kind of the neoliberal kind of, playbook. But in the context here of kind of the added possibilities, given the juridical political status of Puerto Rico as a territory and non-incorporated territory. Right. So what I'm interested then is kind of not just looking at how, therefore, what we need to do is, become a state or, an independent nation state, but really kind of track how this, how it intensifies and replenishes a racial order within Puerto Rico itself, so that projects of decolonization, kind of remain at a proximity to those ends, to really kind of interrupting that order, rather than, potentially reinstalling it even through decolonization processes.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and this really is the engine then behind your call for historical reckoning. And you say, this is a quote from you, historical reckoning is subversive if it interrupts modes of binding of a debt economy and the race, gender, class hierarchy that it reinstalls. And I hear, and in your answer, I hear the importance of this double move, right? Statehood or independence, if we're not also attending to that second part, those hierarchies, then in a way, the situation of coloniality remains and it continues doing its work. And so for you, you talk about historical reckoning as a means of attuning to the binding power of debt, and how that can be, that binding power can be subversively redeployed. But this has to be then an aesthetic project. It has to be one that works at the level of the body and sensibility, because what those hierarchies are in part normalizing and making every day are things like anti-Black violence, right? They become, in your use of Christina Sharp, atmospheric. So will you talk about why it's reworking the binding power of debt and why that has to be coupled with attention to aesthetic remaking?
Yeah. So the first chapters of the book kind of, they track how neoliberal coloniality functions or works or operates, And the second chapter, I kind of make it even more concrete, this distinction between, the juridical, political, and especially, the way in which for example, PROMESA, which institutes the Fiscal Control Board or La Junta, just continues this trend of the use of the declaration of states of emergency to install neoliberal rationality and functions as a form of dispossession. What I do in the third and the fourth chapter is really take a look at forms of resistance and contestation that have been at work in Puerto Rico. And what was the most striking for me, especially beginning from the 2016 on, was the fact that people on the streets, collectives, a whole host of kind of political actors, they were not, of course, they were interested in non-payment, questions of, of organizing around non-payment of a colonial debt, of an illegal debt, of an odious debt, so on and so forth. There were many, many discussions about that. But what was most striking was that the ways in which folks organizing were much more interested in what I kind of talk about as the reversibility of debt. So the way of kind of reversing or subverting the positions of power that debt installs. So this idea of the creditor and the debtor. So rather than kind of merely organizing around debt non-payment or debt cancellation, there are many variations and still are of organizing around, the subversion of the debt itself, that it is not our debt to pay, but rather that that there is a debt to be paid to us. Because of the colonial history, so and not just history, but ongoing colonial status in all the ways that I've talked about, not just in the juridical political sense. So the subversive redeployment of debt is just to make a little bit more precise is that occupying the position of power that debt installs and expresses and makes operate by flipping the order, right? You are the debtor, you owe us rather than we owe you. So there are many, many examples of many, especially kind of feminist, anti-racist and anti-capitalist collectives I write quite a bit about in the book. I collaborate with La Colectiva Feminista en Construcción, but there's also Jornada Se Acabaron Las Promesas, Promises Are Over, and many other, kind of there was very lively organization around us, debt audit and so on. And they were all kind of, right, using the very structure of debt, that very kind of deferral, that very form of accounting, as a taking of that position of power and that that opportunity for account giving. And so I do pay quite a bit attention to kind of sensibility and aesthetic remaking in the book, because I'm interested in and the fact that some folks here were writing about the fact that many modes of protest, themselves required kind of a whole shift in the very common sense of the very public uptake of what was the debt, how it got accrued, and what does it mean. So I'm interested in understanding how those kind of the coordinates of sense for that are challenged by that subversive redeployment of the positions of power of debt. So I discuss that quite a bit in the book. But what I do want to say is that I don't just limit it to a need for kind of aesthetic remaking or kind of a shift in sensibility. What I'm interested in is how does the racial norm operate? And I take the racial norm, kind of bourgeois whiteness, that kind of affirms a liberal capitalist, heteronormative, cis-heteronormative sense, how it operates and how it kind of delegitimizes not just other forms of living, but forms of resistance and contestation. I take my exploration of the racial norm, not as a question of aesthetics or sensibility, as something that is not a material praxis itself, but rather it is, when I talk about debt as a form of binding, it's also a form of coloniality because it binds, you know, it generates this idea of the unpayable debt as the failed neoliberal subject and as a failed colonial neoliberal, you know, a colonial subject, as a culpable subject that you couldn't, you know, you couldn't, you know, kind of reap the benefits of the economic system. So this whole kind of discourse about culpability, which animates, you know, this idea of austerity and the need for austerity and privatization and so on, that whole discourse, you know, it makes the racial norm work by binding productivity, propriety, whiteness, cis heteronormativity, kind of a liberal imaginary when it comes to politics. It binds it all together. It deploys it such that other forms of life or forms of contestation, you know, that actually disclose violence, disclose economic and racial and gender violence, they are indexed as themselves violent. So I'm interested in that and how that is very, very extremely astutely intervened by some of the political actors on the ground, especially the collectives that I mentioned. Aesthetic interruption or remaking, you know, sensibility itself, all of those are modes of binding that have to do with the material praxis, because this question of productivity and propriety, you know, is a question about who is culpable and who is not, who can pay with their life through utility costs, through, you know, loss of housing, through, you know, loss of access to any essential service, which is not even named because otherwise, you know, legally other things would kick in terms of debt restructuring. So that's something that I explore quite a bit in the book, how aesthetic and epistemic interruption and remaking is a question of how does the racial norm operate? And by the racial norm, I also mean racial gender norm and class norm operate, and how it kind of gets adapted and reinstalled through debt restructuring. So decoloniality would require, right, a kind of a unbinding from that very desire and that very imagination that captures these very projects of contestation.
Yeah, I'm thinking of so many examples in the United States, of the difficulty that people can have in even registering protest as protest, and the way that the norms that you're talking about can kind of make even watching, for instance, a video of a police killing completely unintelligible to somebody as a killing, right? That the person appears violent as they're being murdered. It just really strikes me as an example of the way this, the hierarchies shape one's ability to even take in the experiences of other human beings and read them as like moral culpability, right? To be killed by state violence is to be morally culpable. And you, so the, you offer many images in the book. There you have all these really amazing images of protests throughout Puerto Rico, and you talk about protests that cross the line, and it's a technical term, right? Like this is it's an important term for you in the book, and so I want to unpack that. But I take it part of what you're doing is showing how these protests fail by certain norms, these norms you've been talking about. These protests are seen as failing according to those norms precisely because they're working on the very production of those norms. They're refusing those norms. They're refusing, for instance, you talk about resilience as one of the latest ways we're supposed to be productive. It's like, well, sure, you've experienced a hurricane. Now be resilient in the face of it, that this is another call to a form of productivity. And so you talk about, I think, the way that the fact that these protests are labeled as failure is in some sense an index of their success as historical reckoning, but that there's still this difficulty in representing then these protests because of the normative frames through which people can take them in, through which they're intelligible to people. And so there's a tension there, right, between being able to like work on the production of these norms and then being able to be understood as even a protest at all. So I don't know if you would help me unpack that, if I'm sort of getting this right, and if there's an example that you want to dive deeper into.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I'm grateful for such a great reader. So that's one of the things that that was extremely striking to me, and you know, this idea, this notion of pasarse políticamente, to politically cross the line, to play on word, because you know, in Puerto Rico, like it's also like estás pasado, te pasaste. It's like also slang for like you exceeded, like you're amazing, but it's also like you really crossed the line with me. It has many valences. And so this Puerto Rican poet and sociologist, Guillermo Rebollo Gil, that he writes about this in a book, Última Llamada. And I was really struck by his analysis because, because of the way in which he explores through an account of or a reflection of, he was part of the student strike in the University of Puerto Rico in 2011. So he writes about these two moments of the strike the strike as kind of, you know, initially is a creative and, you know, kind of exuding all these really positive values of like horizontalism and, ecological, you know, there were, you know, queer, many, many ways of kind of building in common that were part of the student strikers project in 2010. That was actually in response to kind of Law 7, which was kind of a big first austerity measure, and in response to fiscal crisis. So he talks about this, you know, this first moment of protest and its public uptake in tension with the second moment of the protest that was seen as kind of exceeding because of violent confrontations with police and with, you know, so he really kind of, he talks a little bit about, well, not a little, but he gives this analysis of that strike, and he also kind of extends that analysis to thinking about just kind of everyday forms of protest, whereby there's kind of an interruption of sense that doesn't allow for the action to appear as protest at all, but it, you know, it appears as kind of a, you know, a site of violence or stupidity or, you know, not a protest at all. And so what I do is, you know, I was interested in thinking about kind of the something he made very clear, which was that, you know, a lot of the protest and a lot of forms of organizing have become kind of scripted, and they become, you know, sites of scripted propriety. And so he defends all of these moments of excess that are seen and kind of get chastised by the public uptake or in public uptake. He defends them as kind of hopeful protests in their failure, because they really would require a transformation of the framework of sense itself, of the coordinates of sense, to be able to grasp them as protest at all. They're seen as violence, as excess, and so on. I was really interested in that, and especially in exploring kind of all these ways in which, again, kind of, you know, scripted propriety, all these ways in which even in the most promising of, you know, political projects, you know, they end up reinstalling, you know, the racial gender class norm, and thereby end up kind of adapting the very material, juridical, epistemic, and aesthetic forms or coordinates that lead to their forms of precarity or violence in the first place. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm trying to struggle with in those chapters, to think about, you know, all of these moments of protest that are fleeting, but they're hopeful because they break something, and they might not come to something as a political project of a new nation state or something of the sort, but they certainly challenge, sense itself and common sense itself. Unfortunately, they thereby most of the times, you know, are seen as forms of violence or are seen as forms of stupidity or excess or lack of control or so on and so forth. So I'm interested in that. I'm interested in how, you know, how the racial norm operates and how its interruptions, you know, by and large, you know, they end up failing or they end up being co-opted in the process of really contesting its very operation. So there are many examples in the book. I tried to be as concrete as possible, and you know that my aim in the book was really also to just you know quote as much and you know center as much folks that were writing here in Puerto Rico and were also writing from their experience of being activists in these acting in these processes. La Colectiva Feminista en Construcción is a feminist collective that is, draws from the tradition and of Black feminism and decolonial feminism, anti-capitalist organizing as well. They have been really incredible in, finding different ways of as an organization, as a political project, of really kind of challenging those bounds of sense. So they did, for example, a feminist embargo where they went to banks and, you know, through protest kind of these banks had to like shut down, and there were banks that were linked to the housing crisis that is linked to the debt crisis. And so they, in inverting those positions of power, through, for example, it's, you know, having the banks closed down even for a couple of hours, they're trying to kind of, it's a pedagogy in linking the debt crisis with racial and gender violence, in particular, you know, kind of the fact that women, and especially also not non-white women and Black women in Puerto Rico, are the most impacted by the housing crisis, labor crisis, and other forms of gender violence. They also did a plantón feminista, like a sit-in that you know just this year actually was they called for a declaration of state of emergency of gender violence because of, especially in the context of the debt crisis, but after Maria and then in the pandemic, cases of femicide and domestic violence, trans femicide, just very much on the rise. So in this year, it was, you know, they're subverting that very mechanism by which neoliberal rationality was installed in Puerto Rico, the declaration of state of emergency, to try to kind of fiscalize or like make the state and its, you know, its all of its arms responsible for the material conditions of the lives of those who were impacted by gender violence. You know, just recently this March, they did another because of two cases of femicide. They did another set of protests that followed up on this sit-in, on this plantón feminista, where they went. They didn't just do kind of a march. They did a sit-in in front of La Fortaleza, the governor's house. They did a sit-in. Then they went for a whole week of different protests. They went to the Justice Department, the police headquarters, and then to the mayor's centers. And in fact, like, were able to have folks in 38 different towns in Puerto Rico organized on their own different kind of sites of accountability to their local government to ask, where is the state of emergency of gender violence? Mm-hmm. Where is it? And it's, you know, to try to kind of, again, you know, I see it as a pedagogy whereby, you know, they interrupt this idea that this is kind of a, you know, a personal problem, that this is not a systemic issue, that it's not just a patriarchal or an issue of patriarchy, but it has to do with, you know, with it has to do with race. It has to do with class. It has to do with how the debt crisis has intensified those modalities of racial gender violence. So these are kind of the ways in which, and those are two examples of many other things that they have done, but ways of, again, trying to, you know, interrupt common sense, and thereby try to disclose the very kind of the connections between the debt crisis and which seems as a very abstract thing, a financial crisis, but its effectivity, its work is actually in the very material conditions of Puerto Ricans.
Yeah, and I just have to note that your book is an amazing archive of protests. You do a wonderful job, I think, of giving your readers a real sense of a long-standing work of protest in Puerto Rico. And then your conclusion is titled Decoloniality as Reparations, which I think makes so much sense coming out of what you were just saying in particular. By putting these concepts together, you show that they necessitate undoing current necropolitical conditions in order to bind life anew, right? To interrupt life as it's happening and to bind it anew. And you discuss this binding anew as a disordering. And you link that disordering to pessimism. And so will you talk for a moment, what does it mean to organize pessimism? It's so rich. This ending is so rich. So I'd love to unpack it a bit.
Yeah. So there, you know, I'm quoting Rafael Bernabe, who's quoting Walter Benjamin, who's quoting Pierre Nabil.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I'm interested there is, you know, and so the chapter Decoloniality on Reparations. So I was interested in kind of thinking about this longstanding tradition of land, what was called in the 70s land rescue, like land occupation. And so what does it mean to occupy land in occupied land? So it's a form of, you know, it has been throughout the entirety of the 20th century a way of dealing with a housing crisis, questions of migration within the archipelago, of displacement, of forms of, you know, of managing forms, different rounds and different ways of forms of dispossession. But they're also a way of kind of taking back what is owed. So it's a way of, you know, going back to Raquel Salas Rivera's poem. So it's a way of kind of owning to the fact that, you know, what does it mean to be the heir of a debt? Well, in fact, if the debt is, if the position of the creditor and the debtor is inverted, then this is mine to take. And so I kind of explore a little bit that very kind of longstanding tradition of taking back land in Puerto Rico. So I kind of call this I say that it can be seen as a form of reparations because of, I don't want to stay with just the aesthetic problem that we were just talking about with protest. I wanted to, you know, to make very clear that this is about, you know, material conditions. So I explore that a little bit. It requires much more space than, you know, I have in the book. So that is another project. But so I wanted to explore that. And I wanted to also kind of call it reparations, but again, kind of dislocate reparations from a liberal discourse. Because I'm worried about this idea that, you know, debt restructuring or even debt cancellation or debt forgiveness is an entry back into financial health or to the financial markets. So that might ameliorate the situation of the current debt crisis. If it were done in a way that is, you know, redistributive in a just way, but that is not going to dismantle the conditions that generated this debt in the first place, this financial debt, but also the debt, you know, that is historical, that has to do with a history of material dispossession, epistemic dispossession, all of these forms of dispossession that are not just the legacy of colonialism, but the ongoing coloniality. So I wanted to talk about reparations, but not in a liberal context, not in the context of, you know, here is a blank check, then we can absolve the creditor or the, you know, the true debtor of their debt. I'm interested in this notion of pessimism, in the way that that, you know, Bernabe and Benjamin talks about it, because it is precisely geared against the liberal imaginary of progress, of this question of, you know, inclusion, progress, access, you know, restoring financial health, access to, to kind of the capitalist modern world through development, even in an ecological key. So questions of inclusion or rights or the status question of statehood versus the nation state. So I was interested in kind of, you know, notions that, you know, that really challenge that capture of even the most promising of political projects that are contesting this very order. And so rather than optimism, rather than kind of any type of utopian impulse, I think pessimism, because it is a world that is kind of collapsing, that maybe should not be restored. This world of capitalism, the way that the racial norm operates. And so to be a pessimist about those conditions is to think about material conditions here and now and bind them anew in a different key. I've been working a little bit with kind of questions of counter memory and dystopia that kind of push back against this kind of liberal takeover of like catastrophe or, you know, apocalypse, or especially like in the context of the pandemic. I do it by thinking a little bit, reading Juliette Espinosa and Cydia Hartman and, kind of decolonial feminism and the Black decolonial feminism and from the Caribbean, in the Caribbean, and Afro-pessimism, and to really think about what would it mean to kind of think about decoloniality in a way that doesn't get co-opted by the liberal imaginary of inclusion. Because the whole point of decoloniality is to understand to index and to really unbind those systemic those systems that are in place that permit the adaptation and renewal of kind of this racial order that is necessitated by capitalism and its aim of profit. So pessimism is a way of, you know, what do we have in front of us here and now that could, you know, bind life anew without it being, you know, kind of turning away from the keys of kind of the liberal imaginary that is the epistemic kind of aesthetic arm of the capitalist modern world.
Great. Well, so what are you working on now?
Well, I'm starting this very initial stages of this project, you know, Subversions and Refusals of Private Property. Awesome. By just thinking about that, racial regimes of property, coloniality, and kind of different forms of contestation, subversion, refusal of kind of the questions of private property land in the Caribbean. So mostly in Puerto Rico, but the project might also have other points of contact. So it will grow out of some of the work of the conclusion for sure.
Oh, that's great. I'm so glad. Yeah, there's so much in it. So I'm glad you're going to pick up some of those threads. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for this discussion today.
Thank you so much, Sarah.